Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guests are co-directors Mick Maggie. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
And Oscar Lahama.
Close enough. Yeah, thanks for having us.
Please correct me on air then, so people can hear how it's supposed to sound.
Oscar Lahama.
Thank you. Apologies. We've not had many rehearsals, so I'm going to let myself off this one time. We've not come on here to talk about how I pronounce names. We've come on the podcast to talk about your movie, the old man movie, Lactopocalypse. Does one of you want to give us a brief synopsis as to what the hell that is about?
It is a movie about an old man who lives in a farm, and he is visited by his grandchildren. And the grandchildren now have to stop an exploding cow, because everybody knows that if the cow's udder isn't milked for 24 hours, then the cow is going to explode and cause an lactocalypse.
And can you add anything else to that, Oscar? Would you add any other more colors to that?
I can add a few colors. Like, I think like the titular old man is the grandfather, and he sort of is really set in his ways. And I think it's about like his ways of doing things and grandkids' ways of doing things, like really clashing throughout the film. And I think that's where the conflict comes from. And that's why kind of like it's very, very early in the film, like kind of it was a little bit the kid's fault that the cow gets away. So, so that's how everything starts unraveling. And I think mine and Mick's one of our favorite characters in the film is the antagonist.
Old Milker.
who has actually survived one lactocalypse. So and he after that is a man made thoroughly out of milk. Yeah, and he wants to get revenge and kill the cow. So this is like all those parties are meeting and chasing each other, and it's a really fun romp.
I'm trying to imagine now for the listener that wasn't aware of this film, where their imagination is gone given those descriptions thus far.
Did we even mention that it's a stop motion animation?
No. I was going to say it was, but I was going to wait to see if you actually said it, and neither of you said it. I did invite you, Oscar, to say if you needed to say anything more.
All right. I said everything but that. But basically, I'll jump in with the main fact that it's a stop motion animation. It's a really colorful and adventurous film with a lot of creatures and crazy characters. So that's really important, the piece of the puzzle.
And it has a really great scene with a tree and a tractor that we thoroughly enjoyed making. And I think it has the longest fart joke in cinema history in it.
Is that going to be on the poster? The longest fart joke in cinema history?
Oh, it should. That's a great idea. Yes. That should be on the poster.
Thank you for that. And thank you for everything you told us there about the film. For those listening in the UK, the old man movie Lactopocalypse is available in UK cinemas from Friday the 2nd of June, but there is a series of preview screenings starting Wednesday the 24th at home in Manchester, and then on to Edinburgh, Glasgow, BFI Southbank, Bristol, Truro, and then back to the London Picture House Central. And I think the Picture House chain are going to be playing it across their whole suite, across their, all their cinemas on their Culture Shock film night, which is Monday, the 29th of May. And you're going to be on tour with the film, aren't you? I believe Pat's your wingman, taking you up and down Scotland and England. And how what's your plan there for the nights where you're going to be with your film?
I guess there's going to be like Q&A, so we get to introduce the movie and afterwards answer some questions. And yeah, I don't know. I am very excited to come to UK because I've never been there before. So to get to visit London and Manchester and everything in one go is exciting.
And I guess for the listener who can hear your accent but might not be able to place it, do you want to tell us where you're from, the pair of you?
We're from a small hobbit country called Estonia.
We are from Eastern Europe.
We're from Estonia. Yes. Hello.
It takes a long time to get used to speaking English for us. It's like, you know.
It's actually, yeah, we're from...
For me.
You're not my first Estonian filmmaker.
But we have to be the first ones on your podcast, right?
With the worst English.
No, are you kidding me? What Estonian has been on your podcast?
Well, it's a bit of a fudge. He's a Spanish filmmaker, but he's based in Estonia.
Miguel.
Yeah.
Miguel is a great guy. Yeah, of course. Yeah, I should have figured. Was he with Jesus Shows You the Way?
Indeed, yes. Okay, and the podcast episode that we recorded ended up being the DVD extras for the German release.
Oh, well done. Mm. Cool, so cool, yeah.
But you are the first Estonian filmmaker, if that makes sense, to come on the podcast. So you've got a first. Mm. Well, look, you also co-wrote this as well as co-directed it. So given the wild ideas that you were telling us in the synopsis, what was at the heart of this? When you conceived this idea, what was the little seed that gave us the flower that is the movie today?
To be honest, I think that, you know, as with every movie, I think like the conception and then the brainstorming and like writing the first treatment is always the like most fun part, because there you like all the ideas are on the table and you get to like, you know, to just like dream for a living a little bit. But I think what made this making this movie special for me was that I think we clicked with Oscar very well, and it was like a very enjoyable process because we were really like in tune, and I think we've like discovered each other as like fellow film nerds or film geeks. So we were coming from different places, but I think we really like shared the love and the enthusiasm of like making this kind of film, and like the like we wanted to make it like good, you know. So, you know, we wanted to give us our best, and it was fun to make it.
I think most British viewers won't know that the character of Old Man actually is created by Mick and his university friend Peter Rizzo, and they together created the character years ago as students, and it sort of became a viral, just the basic character, like Vanamees or in Estonian or Old Man, was this claymation character. And it sort of weirdly went viral, and it's one of the most bizarre pop culture phenomenons in Estonia. It's this weird, scary, really raunchy, bizarro character went viral, and they did like a bunch of really cool sketches, and Old Man started sort of popping up in commercials, and it became such a small like niche pop culture phenomenon.
Yeah.
And then at one point, somewhere 2017 probably, they decided to make a feature length film of this character, which was a wild idea. Like, now you see the film, but the inception of it was even wilder, in the sense that no one thought this could even be a feature length character or feature length film character. And that's the point where Mick got me on board, and we sort of loosely knew each other, but in the making of this film we became very good friends.
What do you remember being the main storytelling challenges about expanding what was a short viral thing into a, you know, 90-minute full-length feature?
I think one of the criticisms that we got like early on was like when we explained the idea of making a feature-length film based on this Old Man character, because like he was mainly known from the sketches. So everybody was like, oh, how can you like stretch this sketch into like a feature-length film? It's never going to work. So maybe the hardest challenge was to like give the world like some kind of depth or to expand this universe, like, and the characters in the sketches, mainly the children characters, are very like, how do you say, like thin, or their character is just like, oh, they like react to whatever grandfather is doing. But now we had the challenge, okay, we're going to spend like an hour and a half almost together with them. And so this like high-pitched whining is going to get like annoying at some point for sure. So like, let's make them a little bit older, like let's give them names, etc. So yeah, I think expanding the world was like one of the biggest challenges maybe.
Okay. And what about you, Oscar? What do you remember being challenging from a storytelling point of view?
Oh, totally. Everything that Mick said. And I think like there's also this sort of this balancing act of create, like giving this, like Mick said at the beginning, like we wanted to make it like really good in the sense, of course, every filmmaker wants to make a good film, but we wanted to make it like, I think it was sort of our like on our masthead, Mick, like we wanted to make like not an old man sketch as it was before, but we wanted to make an old man movie, like a movie for a big screen, like, and in the way that we will probably talk to you, Stuart, about our influences like later on. But I mean, we grew up on watching like big movies on the big screen and white screen format, and you know, and it seemed so silly to take this stupid little claymation sort of character and put it on a big screen and like make it so that it had to be epic. And I think that was like kind of tricky, because to root this very absurdist character in this epicness, we really gave it a structure of a quite, you know, hopefully like a solid enough story structure of a sort of Hollywood blockbuster movie. But then the balancing act, to answer your question, like the balancing act then became like, okay, how not to make it, how to still be like retain this absurdist energy of this character and not make it just like a flat, I don't know, like Transformers movie, and still be like sort of quite wacky and crazy and unpredictable, like the character was, like very like punk rock type of sort of weird origins of this character, to retain this DNA in this structure.
And there were a lot of like practical difficulties, like how to make how will they milk the udder of the cow, and how to make that, we have to make like different lengths of this, how do you say that,
the teats.
So like how will they like stretch, and then I remember like sitting with Oscar and it's like young like puppet makers and artists, and we had this like other, no, the teat isn't like you know, it isn't flexible enough, and like discussing the like the bear's ass, and like how to make, they were really challenging to do, to be honest.
It was such a surreal, like we were, you sort of forget in the making of it, because it's very challenging and very stressful also, and you know, in days, but you have this weird surreal moments where there's like 10 grown up people sitting behind a round table, really serious, and just you know, pointing to a bear's asshole, which is, you know, done from silicone and wire, because it's just
it's not working, you know,
because there's a huge, just for the listeners who haven't seen the film, there's a huge plot point in the film, which is a bear's butt, you know, essentially, and that's the tone of the film also, for everyone who hasn't guessed, there's like a huge bear's butt and stuff happens around it and inside of it, and we just were really explaining, like, you know, guys, you don't understand, the butt has to be flexible, but it has to be, you know, like also not too gross but kind of gross, and you know. And that was basically every day on this film. It's insane, yeah.
For the filmmaker who's listening, who might be used to making live action, what would you say are the pros of doing claymation over live action, but then what become the cons, i.e. the challenges of doing claymation over live action?
Well, you have a lot more control, I guess, over like the setting and like the characters, and like, well, when you start out with animation, there is like nothing in the frame, and you like decide like about every detail, like you have the like maximum control in a sense. But the downside is it takes so long. So like if you have a joke, like, oh yeah, it's the bear's ass or whatever, and in that moment it's super hilarious. But then like 6 months later, you're still making the soap. So it becomes like a marathon. So because it takes so long to make it. So that's maybe one of the challenges.
To give us a full pitch then. So the runtime of the Old Man movie is how long?
Like hour and 20 minutes or so.
Okay.
Around that.
And from a production point of view, how long did that take to complete?
Well, absurdly, like little time frame, actually. I think we like animated it like under a year even.
Which anyone who has worked in stop motion animation will know that this is, you know, like Mick said, absurdly short time. Mm. I think the whole film, from the inception of the idea, like our first meeting behind the round table until the premiere was it like 2 years, Mick?
2 years,
like,
yeah.
Which wow. is like, even for a feature.
For a feature, I mean, that's Ferrari speed. Yeah,
exactly. And now imagine like you have to shoot every single frame, you know, individually. So that's even, you know, it's even crazier.
So if the freedom is one of the pros, what would you say is the cons? I mean, cons the wrong word, but what are the challenges of claymation versus live action?
I would actually expand on Mick's point. I think that you have to create, like, the strength of it is that you have, like Mick said, like everything in the frame you put there, and you have complete creative freedom. And the con is that everything in the frame you put there, and you have creative freedom, which essentially means it's a double-edged sword.
So
you have to, on a practical side, you have to literally build anything. So there's a lot of, you know, our budget was, of course, super, super slim, and we had a super great crew, but very skeleton crew, like very, in the sense, a very small crew. And so our imaginations ran wild, but at the same time, we also had to, you know, we had deadlines and budgets, and we had to, yes, you can put anything in the frame, but there's a lot of the time you have to, oh shit, we have to, you know, like, maybe like not even cut the corner, but I mean, every filmmaker will know you have to like compromise, you know, within reason at every step of the way, basically. So it becomes, this sort of struggle of, we can put everything in the frame, but what can we, what do we have? What do we have time for? What should we put? You know, like that's crazy. Yeah. With every frame, basically.
Yeah. And also like, I guess the spontaneity, or like once you are shooting something, then like to tell the animator, like, I know I told you to do that, but we're going to do it like differently again. So like to look at his face after a week of animating, like, what do you mean? Like, so I guess in live action, it is easier. Okay, let's try this and let's try that, etc. until you get something, or in the editing, you have more like material you can choose from. But in this live, like in claymation, you shoot something and then you have it. And it's much more expensive to like shoot it again.
So in that sense, then when you're in the screenplay stage, you really have to interrogate the screenplay to know what it is you want the animators to then create. You can't, like you say, with live action, you've got reshoots, you can go back again, you know. I mean, they still cost money, but if you paid a claymation animator to do something and then go, oh no, it doesn't work for the, somebody says that doesn't work for the story, then you kind of, you've just cost yourself money for nothing, haven't you?
Pretty much, but you know, filmmaking in general, it is like when you start making something and you see it on the screen, it's such a natural part of the process that then you get some new ideas and, oh, of course this doesn't work now that I see it because of like A, B or C. So it was, it's hard in that sense, because claymation, like doing something again, is like, it's more expensive.
I mean, it's different budget levels, but I've heard filmmakers who've worked on Pixar movies talk about the same thing, you know, with the animators they work with. It's a case of you can't just keep trial and erroring. You have to be sure what it is you want to do.
Mm. I mean, I guess there's this, of course, with Pixar, and I mean, Mick has, so my background is actually in live action, and Mick is a sort of lifelong animator, and he also does like 3D and 2D and like computer animated stuff. And I remember when we were doing this stop motion thing that Mick, you were always like, fuck, if this would be, you know, like if this would only be you know, computer, you wanted to do your next thing in CG basically, because you have a little bit more, the principle is the same, and you cannot do a million takes, but you have a little bit more wiggle room. But stop motion, the notion of stop motion being, you know, sort of you can like prep a lot, if you have time, but then once the animator gets animating, then you sort of, within reason, but you get what you get, right? Like you can still tweak it a little bit and post, clean it up maybe a little bit, but you have what you have then. So like asking for second or asking for a third take is already like absurd in stop motion. Like that's not, you know, you people get very mad. But I think like with this film, I think it was really, because the film and the character and the film are sort of inherently so absurd and you know, I keep saying this word like punk or sort of like almost like anarchy characters that.
Yeah,
sort
of one of the reviews on 606's website describes it as being gloriously unhinged and terrifically transgressive. So, you know, that's punk. That's a punk, very punk rock sounding review of the film. So I understand what you mean.
I mean, that, and by the way, if someone says about it, feels this watching the film, we are, I think, I mean, I don't know about you, Mick, but I'm very flattered by this. I think this is certainly something that we were going for. But I think how we reached it was a little bit almost by accident, because I think Mick had worked in animation, but I don't think anything in that scale. And I had never worked in animation. So Mick was, you know, really just throwing me the ropes in this world. So the way you were asking about the script, I think we were doing the script at the same time as we're doing the storyboard, at the same time as we were building the sets, at the same time we were already shooting, because it was so chaotic. And I think, like, at the time, it was really stressful. I know that it was very stressful for me, at least. But I think hindsight 2020, right? Like, I think that was the only way to make that film with that tone, because it sort of was unhinged, and it was a little bit, you know, like slapped together in the best kind of way, you know. So I think that really informed the end product.
What's some of the tricks of the trade, as it were, for making what essentially is a little model on a table or on a set that you've done on a table, on a counter or whatever, and then making that so when it goes, when we watch it, we believe these things are, you know, life size. You know, what are some of the tricks of the trade there?
Well, I think that Oscar was like really like good at like framing the characters in a way that you know, they looked bigger, and like choosing the angle and the lens and etc. I think the bear sequence in particular is like good, like very well framed in that sense, because the bear wasn't like that big, but it looks really huge and scary, etc. So it has a lot to do with lighting and like camera work, and also I think we had a lot of like references to like Matrix and other like blockbuster movies that we took influence from, so we tried to imitate that in a way.
I also think like it's funny that, I mean, I came to the, like I said, I came to it like from a live action background, and I didn't really know, I don't know if I know now any tricks. I haven't just finished last year, early this year, I finished my second stop motion animation, a short. But I did it like the principle, I did it the same way. And how I lens it is the same way I would the live action. So, I mean, we with Mick, we storyboarded everything in a way and lensed it in a way that how we would love to see it in live action. And I think like we didn't see the small scale as sort of a handicap or like a downside or anything. I think we did everything the way you would do if you would.
All the same rules apply pretty much.
That's a little bit of an introduction to the old man movie, Lactopocalypse. Thank you for sharing some of the experiences and challenges making that movie. I'm going to remind people that film is released in UK and Ireland cinemas on the 2nd of June. I missed out one of your preview screenings. You've got 18th of May, you're at the Flatpack Birmingham. Then the 24th of May, you're at home. Then it's off to Edinburgh. And then the same night, you're playing Glasgow. So two Scottish dates in one evening. That's good going, guys. The BFI South Bank, Watershed Bristol, etc., etc. I'll put a link into the show notes so people can see this, can check it for themselves to see where it's playing local to them. But congratulations on your movie. I can't wait to see it. I'm going to see it when it hits my hometown of Hackney Picture House. So hopefully you'll be around for that, I think. But let's get on to the real business of the podcast. Three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Now, you are part of an experiment because you're the first time I've had two filmmakers on at the same time doing this. So what I suggest we do is we alternate between each other's choices. I have, just for the benefit of the listener who's not familiar with the format, Mick and Oscar have both given me their three choices. We're going to talk about those movies one at a time, and we're going to talk about them two against the clock. So every time the 5 minutes are up, we're going to hear this sound. You can hear that at your end, guys.
Yeah.
I'm going to start with you, Mick. So you just take a deep breath for a second. Your first choice is The Thing. Do you want to tell us, how does a film like The Thing have an impact on your adult life? Where does that start for you?
Because it had a really great impact on my young life as a child. I remember I saw this film from TV and I really didn't know what to expect or what movie is going to start. I just thought, wow, UFO flying. And I thought it's going to be something like Star Wars or something. So I was that's not boring. And so I'm going to watch that one. And for 10 years, I think I had nightmares from the monsters and the music and everything. I loved it. I loved the film, but it was so suspenseful. And for my young mind, all those the monsters and everything, they were they left such an impression on me. I had never seen anything like it. And the music, the dun-dun, the Morricone and Carpenter music, the score, it was I felt uneasy listening to these notes for very, very many years afterwards. And I think I've seen this movie 20, 30 times or something. Now that I'm older, I'm not afraid of it anymore. But it's still, I think it's one of the most suspenseful movies I have ever seen. And all the practical effects are just so well done and so memorable and cool. So yeah. So
age were you when you first saw it? Then when you say you were young, how old was you?
I think I was maybe 9 or something. Or
that's a good age to get nightmares from a film like The Thing.
I remember I saw a film with this the scariest film that I had seen until that time was a film that had this classical gray aliens with big black eyes. And I was having nightmares of the gray aliens. So I was pretty easily scared by aliens. And so, yeah, I saw The Thing and also the movie, the main character of the Kurt Russell guy was such a cool protagonist as well. And I remember it just left such an impression on me.
And as a 9-year-old, how did you come to choose to watch it?
I just randomly, it was on TV. So okay. I didn't know what I'm going to watch. Yeah. I just thought it was going to be a sci-fi action movie or something. So it's like Predator or something like that. So at the time I was really into those old 80s action movies with Schwarzenegger and Stallone, etc. And so I was thinking maybe it's going to be something like that.
I mean, I remember one of my memories, a similar age, was I watched Friday the 13th, the first one. And when Jason jumps out of the water, spoiler for anyone that's not seen it, that was the bit that gave me nightmares, the very closing sequence, the idea that this supernatural thing lived on, because my 10-year-old brain couldn't separate fiction from fact. So what do you remember? What images were the ones indelibly printed on your mind after that first watch?
To be honest, I think it was the setting of the Arctic and the music. It's just I think the atmosphere that was created was just so heavy. Mm. It was so desolate and they were all stuck and there was nowhere to go. So the only place where they went was the other base that was already destroyed. So you can see when you watch the film, then you're starting to think, oh, that's probably what's going to happen to their base. So you get this feeling of there's no way out or very very good atmosphere.
What do you think? I mean, now as a grown up watching it, what do you think John Carpenter does that's so effective with the film? What is it that makes the film? Because like you say, it's the perfect chamber piece, even though we're in the wilds of the Arctic. But it feels it's a one room play, isn't it? In a way, there's not a wild location or anything.
I think there are many things that he does really well there, but if you look past the effects and all the gore, etc., I think the characters are very well directed and very well written. It's they have there is very little exposition in the film, so it's you just you meet the characters, but nobody's I used to be I'm a Vietnam veteran and I am this or that too. So it all you get to, yes. So there is not much exposition, but somehow all the characters are so different and they all have very unique personality. So I think that's one of the things. And I think, yeah, the music and the score also is like something that I would like to mention again, because, yeah.
Time is up.
Yeah.
Right, Oscar, we're moving on to you for your first choice. Genre-wise and tone-wise, you know, we're in a similar ballpark, but a very different outcome. We're talking about David Cronenberg's The Fly. Do you want to tell us how that film has an impact on everything in your adult life?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's painfully obvious how, because I don't know, maybe not from the Old Man movie so much, but from my other work, I love horror films, and I also write and direct horror films, and I think one of the things that I've been very fortunate, one of my short films, to have one of my short films find its audience, and that was also a buddy horror short film called Bad Hair, which is online if people want to check it out. And it's definitely, I mean, I don't consciously all the time think like, oh, this, I want to do something, you know, quote unquote Cronenbergian, but it just is. I mean, I'm not like tooting my own horn. It's not nowhere near as good, but it's a body horror film. It's about a dude like popping pimples in front of the mirror.
No, so it's an amazing short film.
Oh, thanks. But yeah, like I think that's how it sort of influences me to this day. And I think like maybe on how body horror in general influences me.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's just like, I'm just fascinated by the genre, just like the on a sort of philosophical level. I do think we are all just walking bags of meat decaying with every second until we are dead sooner or later. So I mean, that's just fascinating. Like, our bodily functions are just disgusting, and I think even the magical act of, you know, pregnancy and giving birth is, if you think about it, take two steps back, it's just like a nightmare. So I think that's just so fascinating. And I think, like, I don't know that it started with The Fly, but that's certainly my first memory of ever seeing or witnessing something like that.
I mean, how does The Fly come onto your radar, as it were? How are you first seeing it?
Look, I think I have to be quite honest that my two other films are linked to quite specific memories. And with The Fly, it's a little bit more hazy. I have to say, I know for sure that I saw it in my it was a second childhood home. We had moved with my family. That makes me probably like 7 or 8 years old. And I guess I caught it while my father was watching TV, because I explicitly remember it, watching it on seeing it on TV. And I do think, you know what, I think I saw it sort of in fragments, because I don't think my parents would have let me watch it. But I do remember it was in that room. I know it was in that living room in that house, on a TV. And I specifically remember there's a scene where Jeff Goldblum, who plays the main character, he's transforming. For those who don't know, he's a man, a scientist who does a teleportation experiment, which slowly but surely starts turning him into a fly because something has gone wrong in the experiment. And there's a scene where he goes to a bar, and he's just, at first, his supernatural powers and the strength and confidence and whatever are really enticing and kind of cool and giving him a lot of sort of strength and stuff. And he has in a bar, and he does an arm wrestling match with a sort of bully guy, and he breaks the guy's arm, and it's sort of, it breaks it. It's like an open,
wound?
Open bone comes out.
Oh, bone, okay.
Protruding bone. Yes, I don't know if you guys remember, but it's probably a very short, it's a short scene and insignificant probably if you know in the context of a whole piece. And this, and there's so much gore and, you know, wonderful special effects and makeup and stuff. This is an insignificant scene in that sense, in the technical sense. But something about it is, it felt like, and I think this is very much to Cronenberg's credit, that he frames everything. So, like, everything is framed equally. Like, everything, like, look at this. This is happening now. This is happening now. This is happening here. This is happening here. Like, the whole film feels like, I think this film and all his other films also, why I really love him, it's like inevitability happening. It's like rolling. Stuff is rolling. Like, narratives are rolling in front of you. There's a train. You cannot stop it. And this is happening now. And I think that bar scene and that violence in the bar scene, and on a larger scale, the whole film felt like that. And I had never felt anything like that before. And of course, as an impressionable young kid, of course, the violence and the horror of it, of course, was probably the thing that hit me first.
But what's interesting about all that gore and horror is that at the heart of it, The Fly is a love story as well, isn't it?
Of course it is. Of course. And that what makes it so much more painful, so horribly, horribly painful, is that it's Jeff Goldblum. Imagine, like, he's the nicest guy. Of course he's questionable ethics, and as he is transforming, of course he, you know, becomes a quasi villain of the piece. You know?
Yeah, yeah,
very
yeah.
much like a, you know, it's very murky. You know, he does really, really bad things in the film, but you really feel for the guy. It's almost like, you know, Marty McFly would be Oh my God, Marty McFly! That was unintentional, but Marty McFly would start turning into a horrible monster and dying. You know, he's so sympathetic. So yeah, that's the magic trick of that film. Totally.
Thank you for that, Oscar. Mick, moving quickly along, your second choice of film is Braveheart. Tonally, a very different film than The Thing. So how has this film ended up having so much impact on you?
I think I was about the same age when I saw it. Maybe I was like a little bit older, but I was still like, it was before I became like a teenager. So I was like not a teenager yet, but I was like a young boy. And I remember the setting where I saw this movie was like at a private English lesson. And I was together with two peers of the same age, like young boys, like 11 or so. And I remember we were like very competitive in everything, like how well we could play Scrabble or whatever. Like, and I remember the teacher like put the movie on, and we had been watching like some pretty silly like cartoons before that one. Like there was one about like a Massey or some kind of like cartoon character who was eating clocks or something. And so anyways, as with The Thing, I had no idea what I'm going to watch. And I remember this movie, you know, it's very well made. It's very like epic. And it has like everything that would that a young boy would like, you know, like brotherhood, like becoming a leader, like very epic battle scenes, everything like that. But I remember especially that like in the end, like when it starts getting sad, you know, it's so manly and, you know, he's captured and he's not going to like surrender and he's like going to like be true to his values, etc. And then they start like torturing him and it goes on and on and on. And I think like 30 minutes before the end, like I wanted to cry so bad. You know, but I couldn't because the other boys were there. So it became like, you know, I have to like tough it out until then. So I started like, you know, doing the coughs and so, yeah, but I still remember it was so hard. It was like so painful experience in a way, like So I should remember it was such a, like a tough task not to cry. And I think I still like in the very end, like when he shouts like freedom, that I went like you know, I cried a little bit, and one of the boys was like, oh, you know, I was like, bam. Like, yeah, so I couldn't bottle it in anymore, and also like in that movie, the score as well, the music was like so beautiful. So as with The Thing, they're very different movies. But in a way, like the atmosphere and the music, it really it painted a picture that like drew me like into this world, and you know, a little bit like in the Lord of the Rings or something. You know, the music was a little bit like Lord of the Rings-esque in a sense. Yes, I think the score was by James Horner, I think. So
You watched this film at English school, did you say?
We had like a private tutor, so it was like me and two other boys, and so we had like private lessons that paid off really well.
They did. So, but I'm just thinking, where you've got a tutor lesson, and part of that lesson is a 3-hour movie. Did your tutor not want to do any teaching?
Well, no, she was actually very strict, and I don't know. I guess she was like a fan of England and of the movie in general, so she wanted to maybe like shake us a little bit, or you know, show us something cool that she knew that we were going to like, and like, you know, I don't know, just she wanted to give us this experience. So yeah.
But, okay, yeah, I mean, this is what I mean. So you're essentially almost like force feeding yourself English language through a movie. And then having to understand it as much as you understand English at that point.
Yeah, maybe it also had something to do with accents. Like maybe it was like she was like teaching us like, you know, the different accents and something. And so maybe that's why she chose that movie.
Never thought of it that way. Yes, this is how Scottish people talk. Yeah. Cue Mel Gibson.
But now when I have like rewatched this movie, it's like very well made a movie, but it's so like Mel Gibson, so like it's a perfect movie for like a young boy. You know, it's a perfect like adventure, like kind of like an epic tale. But like now when I'm older, then it's like the thing has for me a little bit more like this you know, rewatch value. Maybe now that I'm older, but still it's a very well made movie. And
I mean, 3 hours is a hell of a commitment on a rewatch. The best of films, isn't it?
But that movie as well, I think I have seen it like 10 times at least.
Well, there we go. There's the alarm. Right then, Oscar, we'll move swiftly along to your second movie of your three. Me mixing my words up, looking at lists, getting bombarded with information. Is a film I've not seen, so I'm interested to know a lot about this film, not just the impact on you. So we're talking about Grand Day Out. Do you want to talk us through where you saw this and the impact it had on you?
Yeah, so it's a Wallace and Gromit movie. It's a short film. It's the first Wallace and Gromit short film by Nick Park called The Grand Day Out. And I saw it. This is the one with which I remember very specifically, like where I saw it. I saw it in my grandmother's apartment on an old janky TV. And I remembered I was sitting on the floor and the film came on, and I think it was again like as you would see something on the television, you just probably enter into it like halfway through or something. But I do remember very specifically. So it's a stop motion animation. It's a claymation animation. I can't say maybe how long it's maybe something like 15 minutes or something. This is a short film, but I remember distinctly that it's a very funny, very witty, very fun film. But it somehow scared me. Maybe I was like 4 years old, maybe 5 years old.
Okay,
but it scared me on a level that I think often claymation or stop motion films tend to do, like something aesthetically in the animation and in their staging very often tends to be quite sort of eerie. I think it isn't there to that extent in the other Wallace and Gromit films, which are fantastic, by the way. Like the whole like what Aardman is doing, the studio that created this film and the other Wallace and Gromit films, and Nick Park specifically, the director and brains behind Wallace and Gromit, just fantastic. This is some of the best filmmaking out there in general, live action or animation. But this film specifically is the first adventure of Wallace and Gromit, an inventor and his very trusty friend who happens to be a dog. And they travel to the moon because, as we all know, the moon is made out of cheese. And they are cheese aficionados, and they want to have a holiday where there's a lot of cheese. And there's something about the set design and the audio design and this whole world. It's very whimsical, very fun, but it's also very sparse and sort of a little bit like eerie. And it scared me a little bit, but really pulled me in to an extent that I think I hadn't, you know, really felt at the time. And I think it's very different than the other animation experiences I had at the time, because of course, what, 94, 95 is when like Lion King came out and Toy Story came out. And that was the time when I was, you know, I was in that exactly that age bracket where I watched those films on the big screen. And those also deeply affected me. And I'm not like downplaying them at all. It was all very like rocked my world. But I think something about that claymation specifically, and probably that I saw it in my grandmother's apartment, who sadly passed away like around that time also. I was very close to her. So it's sort of all those like memory works in a weird way, right? Like I think this, all those set like the smells and the sounds and the feeling of seeing this film for the first time was, this is all like melded together in my brain so thoroughly. And today as an adult, as just a filmmaker, I think, I mean, I'm literally here talking to you because my stop motion animation that I did with Mick. Yeah. So, I mean, in a weird way, like maybe I'm not like big on sort of esoterics or something, but I think like maybe it somehow subconsciously like guided, like I knew that I had as a filmmaker, I knew I had to get back to, I'm not back, but I knew I had to get to that particular form of filmmaking, maybe subconsciously, because that's what happened.
With your filmmaker head on now as an adult, not the 4 or 5 year old that saw it, but what do you think Nick Park got so right? Because obviously the studio output has been a hit after hit after hit. I don't think there's been a bum note, has there? What does he get so right with the way he does stop motion animation?
I think he just has a perfect, like, he has a perfect blend of adventure and whimsy and really cool characters and storytelling. And I know I'm pretty much, this is nonsense sentence, because I pretty much said like he's just really good at films, but basically that's what it is. It's like a round, really well-rounded package. Because I also think that his humor as a kid, as a teenager, I saw a lot of stuff like, you know, for example, South Park, which was really influential, and you know, Team America, World Police, and all that stuff. But I think like Nick Park humor and like the Aardman humor, very specifically, it's so timeless and so like, I don't want to, like, inoffensive in a way that...
Well, I guess universal would be the word.
Yeah, exactly. That's a perfect place to end, because exactly. He's universal. He's very universal filmmaking, and universal humor is what I think like draws people in regardless of age and nationality.
Right then, Mick, your final choice is, and in a way, it speaks to a very esoteric three choices that you've given us. I remember seeing this one at my local art house cinema when it came out. I'm indeed talking about Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man, starring Johnny Depp.
I chose that movie because I remember I watched this movie in my teenage years. I think I maybe was like 15 or something. And I just thought that it was like the coolest movie I had ever seen, in a sense. It was just like the cinematography. And, you know, it's a very like poetic and existential movie, like where not much is happening. But it is really hard to make this kind of a movie, I think, so that it's really like good, or like so it's enjoyable for others to watch as much as it was for you to make, in a sense, you know. So it's like a very like a movie that someone out of like this film school would make, like in a way. Like, but I think the humor was like the dark humor and the poeticness and like the sadness, and also like the humor of the film mixed with the cinematography and the music. It like created such an atmosphere that like really stuck with me for a long time. I just thought it was like very like cool, in a sense, like, and also like the characters and the performances of like Johnny Depp, the performance was very good, and also like the idea of like him being William Blake, and then the Native American character Nobody, who like couldn't wrap his head around the fact that, you know, someone can like in like Western world, people can have like two people can have the same name. So because and him being named Nobody, because no, he was like he who speaks a lot but says nothing. So the idea that he traveled to, like, was taken to the Western world and saw all those things, but when he was brought back, like no one like believed what he was saying. So I don't know, these like ideas really like stuck with me, And also the score, the music, the Neil Young score, I think is one of the best, like kind of like indie movie scores that I have heard. And I used to listen to that one a lot, and I still do. And yeah, so, and for me, it was like, I saw it at the time, like it's about like a character who's like searching for his place in the world, I guess. And as he's like the, you know, Tony Darko and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and those movies. So I guess I was like a teenager and like in a similar place myself in life, I guess. So like I was, you know, searching myself and like meaning and, you know, like who am I and what I want to do and et cetera. So I guess that's why those movies like really resonated with me.
It's fascinating what you're saying about the score, because that's something that I remember well. And then when you go back, you look at it now and it's like, that was mostly improvised by Neil Young. It wasn't like he wrote a score, it was edited, it was this. It was like, he literally did like, I guess he must have done like a performance either two or more abstract without the film at all. And then and then Jim Jarmusch used what he got.
Yeah. So yeah, the music and the picture were so infused together. It was like, you know, almost like in a very good way. So yeah. And come to think of it, like all the movies that I have chosen, or like when I was like thinking what movies to talk about, like all the movies had very like strong scores, and I hadn't like really thought about it, or the music was like used very well in those movies. So I think subconsciously, like music for me is like such a like big part of whether I'm like going to be like immersed in a film or not. So yeah.
And in some senses as well, I mean, I might be getting this wrong, but thinking on memory, like where certainly US indie cinema was going, the idea of trying to do a Western period thing and black and white was slightly obtuse, to say the least, you know, in terms of what's the obvious thing to do in 1995.
And probably the movie like did really bad in the box office, I can imagine, like terribly. And I think all the movies, The Thing and, you know, the... Oh, no, okay, Braveheart. So,
no, Braveheart was quite successful, I think it's safe to say.
Yeah, but yeah, so I guess it didn't do very well in the box office. But I want to say that, you know, the Tarkovsky Stalker is a little bit like also like a movie of like people searching their place in the world, in a sense. But I remember I watched that movie as well, and it was very intimidating and I enjoyed it. But in a sense, I think like Dead Man is like something similar, but dare I say better.
Wow.
No,
that's a big shout.
No. But when I'm,
I haven't even broadcast it yet, and that's echoing in the film community.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say the bell saved you. The bell stopped you from embarrassing yourself even further, to be honest with you.
More accessible.
Hey, look, it's all opinions. It's all subjective. If you think it's better...
No, I loved The Stalker, but with Stalker, it was that because I had read the book before, so the main character was so whiny for me, so that was like maybe... He was like, oh, I don't want to be the stalker. Like, it's so hard to be the stalker. But in the book, he's like a badass.
I'm teasing. Look, receive wisdom and subjective opinion are not the same thing. I think you can you can think, I don't know, Smoking the Bandit's better than Stalker if you want.
Yeah.
I think you're wrong.
Yeah, I am wrong. I know I'm wrong.
You are wrong.
Yeah. On that difference of opinion... we're going to move on to Oscar's third choice. A movie, I think, even bigger than Braveheart, and certainly a movie that I think in 21st century, I mean, what is it, 1999, is it? Is it 99? Yeah, 99.
Yes.
As arguably had a huge amount of impact on culture outside of it just being a movie. I mean, it's quite phenomenal, really, in terms of how instructive it was in terms of the fucked up mess we're in now. When it was, because The Matrix is one of those perfect screenplays, I would argue. And sorry, I jumped in there. So your third choice is indeed The Matrix. Do you want to talk about how you come to see this the first time and how it ended up being a film you think of as having impact on you?
I remember specifically where I was sitting. I went to see it in Pärnumaa Cinema, which is from my hometown, from my childhood. And I went with my older sister, Trine, and her friend, Lise. And we were sitting, I don't know exactly, I don't know the specific numbers of the seats, but I remember and it was the back half, the right, and because the cinema was completely packed. And I just remember why I remember it. There's a few of those pivotal moments in life, but I remember I was 11 years old, and I remember watching this film and feeling like the ground shifting underneath me. I had never seen anything like this. And it's just it's a kind of feeling that I don't think, you know, it's so profound that I think it's true for a lot of stuff that we experience as a kid, and certainly a lot of films that we experience in youth. And there are a few of those films, certainly in maybe my 20s also, but I don't think anything like this, you know, it was crazy. To me, this was a complete game changer. I had never seen storytelling like this. I think what like drew me in initially, and I think like for this first viewing especially, was just the world and the world building and the effects and how it, you know, the execution of it. It's just I've seen it like a billion times since. I don't even know. I haven't counted. I watched it like twice every year probably. And I mean, I love this, some individual scenes so much that I've seen them like individually on YouTube. I just want to pop in the subway fight, you know. I'm just going to put on the subway fight, watch it for 5 minutes, and then go on with my day. So I've seen this film a million times, but the first time, I think I was just... So I didn't even get the philosophical, you know, the context of the film or the undertones, the filmmaking. I was just struck by this film because it's just... And I remember specifically one moment. There's one specific moment. I was watching this film, totally sucked into it. And there's a moment where the agent, Agent Smith, plants a bug inside our protagonist Neo's belly, which is, by the way, I just realized it's body horror essentially. It's very body horror. And this scorpion-y, spidery looking machine crawls into Keanu Reeves' belly button, and it's super well executed. And I heard this like screams and crying. I heard like a child's cries in the cinema. And I just like, I remember like panning from my view of the screen to the left. And there was like a 6 or 7 year old little girl who was just holding, sitting next to her parents and holding her tummy and just like crying. Like, I don't want to be here. And I was a little bit older, but I was also like shell shocked. I was like, yeah, you and me both, you know, that was like, it was crazy. I just felt there was like every beat of this film, every horror beat, every action beat, everything landed 100%. And I think, like, I you mentioned the perfect script, you know, and I do agree that The Matrix has the perfect script. I would even go as far as to say, you know, we all understand that it's sort of tongue-in-cheek, but I would call it the perfect film. It's so tight. It's just the tightest film. It's just so good all around. So, yeah, The Matrix.
No, because on paper, it's a ridiculous concept, the idea of getting access to that parallel universe, which is the Matrix, as opposed to the world that we think is real. But yet, the film manages to pull off that kind of sleight of hand where you don't feel like you see the join between the world that we're talking in now and then this other world which is ruling what we do.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally. I mean, and you know what is fascinating? Because, I mean, I think this exercise is so fascinating. Why I really love that this exercise that you gave us, like films that in our adulthood also sort of influence us that we saw as children. This film, I watched it so often, and I watched it last time, maybe like last year, end of last year. Well, no, early this year, probably, because I was in a really rough spot. Like my last film was about to finish, and it was sort of in a depression, as you are, and when you finish like a long project. And I remember watching The Matrix, and normally I watch it, you know, I get very different emotions, but I'm never like also moved to tears by it. But in the end, like the third act, you know, there's this beat where like Neo, essentially, who is the one, he, you know, Morpheus, he decides not to run away and starts believing him in himself. And, you know, someone asks like, oh, what is he doing? And Morpheus, who is the mentor, is saying like, he's beginning to believe. And I remember watching this, I'm all alone, you know, with my laptop on my lap and just like alone in a dark room. And I teared up because I thought like, I'm also beginning to believe in myself. And, you know, like it became this film that through like hundreds and hundreds of viewings had transformed into sort of a story of self-realization and stuff. So it's like every time it's something new and it's beautiful. It's a lovely film.
Well, look, guys, that was a fun experiment to do two side by side. Hopefully you got something from it too. One last question for you both, and if Mick answers it first, and then Oscar asks it. So, thinking about these six films, Can you see the influence at all in these six from these six films in the old man movie, Lact Apocalypse? You answer that first, mate.
Yeah, I definitely can, because like a lot of those movies are like blockbusters in a sense, like The Matrix and Braveheart, etc. They have a very like the structure is like very in place. So that's something that we wanted to do with the old man movie as well. And maybe like The Dead Man and this kind of movies and The Fly and, you know, there are elements of all these movies, I think, in the old man movie, in a sense.
What about you, Oscar? Yeah. What do you see? What could you extrapolate directly from the six examples we've got that people might see or you feel is there in the old man movie?
It's wild that you're asking us, because I feel that there's only Dead Man, I guess I cannot pinpoint it, but everything else is kind of in there. Like quite, you know, we really wear our influences on our sleeves too, because there's like literally, I don't know, Mickey, if you remember this, but there's literally shots that we took from The Matrix. Like there's a moment where one of the characters slides down a pipe, which is we showed the frame to the team where like Neo, as he is awakened in the post-apocalyptic world, he slides naked, you know, down a pipe, and the editing patterns and stuff. So it's like, it's not even just like, oh, I wonder how it is influenced. It's like very, because specifically some shots are taken from those films. So I think like through and through, I think if you go and watch this film and if you listen to us here, then I think you will see all of those influences very clearly on screen, in a weird way.
Well, I'm just going to remind people then. So the film is officially out in UK and Irish cinemas on the 2nd of June, but starting on the 18th of May, there are preview screenings. I will put a link in the show notes as to where those are. You're going to be touring with the film. And then on the 29th of May, which is Culture Shock, Culture Film Night at the Picture House chain, you're going to be in all the cinemas on that day. So anyone listening that wants to see the film, listening to this before those dates, check the show notes for links and you can go see the film too. But it just gives me to say, thank you very much. Give your time on the BritFlix podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Stuart.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.